Welcome, everyone, to episode 66 of Underserved. Today in studio, I have with me Matt Wood, Deputy CTO for the Massachusetts Department of Transportation. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Welcome, Matt, and thank you for joining us here today on Underserved.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So you grew up in the Coventry area of England, probably a little different than growing up here and getting interested in technology. What was that like?
Yeah, some of the technology is definitely a little different. My first introduction was actually through my brother. He was the real techie in the family growing up. And he got a ZX81, which are from Sinclair, or a ZX81, I guess you would say over here. But I don't think it was that big outside of the UK. It was in 1981, as the 81 would suggest. Very basic black and white, plugs into your TV, sort of membrane keyboard. I do remember it had 1K of RAM. You know, that was what we were dealing with back then. We were lucky enough that we got the 16K expansion pack. Although that came with its own problems, it plugged into the back, but it was not quite as secure as you'd like. So wobbled a little bit occasionally, and you'd be in the middle of doing something, and something would maybe knock the table, and that would shake, and the whole thing would crash, and you were back to square one. So he used to enjoy coding on that, so on. Personally, you know, at that time, I wasn't really into that, but I did enjoy the games. The one I remember most on that computer it's gone under a few different names. I don't remember what it was in that iteration, but Moria was one of them, Catacombs was one of them, but it was just simple ASCII characters, and you were exploring a dungeon of some kind and looking for treasure and fighting monsters. Your character was just like a little at sign, and then the monsters would be different ASCII characters, the treasure would be different ASCII characters, and it only showed you the immediate area around you, and as you explored, you saw more of the dungeons and discovered these things, and that's my first memory of technology. Back then.
Finding your way around the map.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, speaking of map, like, what was Coventry like? Like, what's that part of England like?
So I always think of Coventry as the Detroit of England. There's a number of reasons for that. It is at least was the home of the motor industry. Where I went to school, we actually backed up onto the Jaguar plant. So over the fence there, they were making all the Jaguar cars. And British Leyland and Austin and those kind of companies were all based out of there, Triumph. I also think of it as Detroit, maybe less positively, in that it's not the most pleasant of cities in there, to be honest, and nothing against Detroit. I have been there, actually enjoyed my time there, but Coventry used to be this beautiful town. It dates back to before the 10th century. I don't know exactly how far back, well over 1,000 years ago, you'll find records of Coventry. And it had these beautiful buildings from the 16th century, 17th century, and so on. And then during the Second World War, it was one of the big targets for the German Luftwaffe, the bombing campaigns. And so a lot of it was flattened. There's still little spots here and there where you see a really beautiful little street with all the old houses. Most of it got rebuilt in the 70s, and that really wasn't a great thing, to be honest.
Very, very industrial looking.
Yes, yeah, exactly, yeah.
So you mentioned the ZX81. Like, did you have any of the computers that we grew up on here, like Commodores or TRS-80s or anything like that?
We didn't personally, but one of my brother's close friends at school, they seemed to go through computers. Like, every couple of months, they had a different one. They were a very different situation to us. But yeah, they had a TRS-80, Commodore 64. I think a VIC-20 was one of the other ones I remember. So I was trying to remember, there was one I can't remember the name of. I used to love playing Spy Hunter on it. It wasn't the Commodore 64, but it was something else. But that was one of my favorite games on that computer.
I love Spy Hunter in the arcade, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you guys had another one that was unique to the UK, the BBC Micro?
Yeah, we didn't have the BBC. We had the cheaper brother of the BBC. So BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, they sort of sponsored this computer that was called the BBC Micro. That was provided to a lot of schools and so on. It was a very common computer for kids growing up in the UK in that time. And the company that made that was called Acorn, and they did their own budget version of that, was called the Electron. I used the same sort of operating system and a lot of things. you could transfer between the two and so on. So it was familiar for a lot of people who had access to the BBC. So we did have one of those as well, which was, that was, I want to say that was the one we got after the ZX81, was the Acorn Electron.
Now, you told me about another one that I had not heard of, the Amstrad 6128. What's the story behind that thing?
Amstrad stands for Alan Michael Sugar Trading. So he was, and I think I've referred to him in the past as being the UK's equivalent to Donald Trump. Not in all aspects. He has not been prime minister yet. But I think the reason people will make that comparison is he's the host of The Apprentice in the UK. And he's a businessman. He's done a lot of different things. And he's got some similarities in style, I think, to Donald Trump. He built a lot of different technology things. I remember at one point he had a phone designed purely for emails. You hooked into your phone line and had a little screen and you could send emails. I don't think that one was particularly successful, but he's obviously been very successful. And with the Amstrad, the 6128, that was a computer my brother had, want to say, after the Acorn Electron, that ended up being handed down to me. So I was lucky enough to get that. And that was my first exposure to having my own computer. And I used it for a lot of games, but that was when I started actually playing around with coding. Obviously, you know, start with the basics of using BASIC, right? 10, print hello, 20, go to 10, that kind of stuff. And then I decided to get a little bit more ambitious and thought, well, maybe I'll write my own game. And that was probably a little bit more than I could handle at that point. But I did start to get a little bit more involved and understand a bit more what it really took to try and write code and build something useful.
So you caught the bug, but I don't think there was much CS in your school. Now, your school system's a little different than the US, right, in high school?
Yeah. I mean, if you've read the Harry Potter books, you probably get something of a feel for how the UK school system is. O-levels and A-levels, they're not L's in the real world, but that's based off some of the standard UK setup. So you do O-levels at age 16, and A-levels at age 18. At least when I was at school, it was roughly about a quarter of the students would continue on to do the A-levels. Most people were finishing up at the O-level at age 16 and going off to work in a trade or do something else, maybe do a different kind of additional education. The concepts of things like prefects and houses, if you've read Harry Potter, that was all there. We had, our school was broken into different houses, and I was a prefect in my house for a couple of years. But yeah, we didn't have any kind of computer courses or really access to any kind of technology in the school. As I got through my O-levels and going into what we call the sixth form, which is where you do the A-levels, there were computer courses available, but they were at different schools in the city. So there were like one or two schools who had that, who would offer computer courses at that point. I wasn't invested in that enough at the time to want to trek across the city for that one lesson every week or whatever it would be.
So do you end up going to university?
Yes. And that was a last minute decision for me. I really didn't know what I wanted to do with my life as a career at that point. When I was 16 and got my O-levels, I was thinking I was going to leave school, and I looked at apprenticeships. Maybe I'll go into a trade. Again, last minute decided, no, I think I'll stay in the education system for a bit longer, and did my A-levels. And again, as I was doing that, I looked at leaving, wanted to go out and get a job, and then last minute decided, no, I'm going to stay with education. And I actually ended up just copying the application of one of my friends who'd already made his decisions and was a little bit more proactive than me about that. I did do a few different things. I looked at what he did and liked some of the stuff he did, and actually ended up going to the same university as him, which was nice to have a friend when I went there. Went to Staffordshire University in Stoke-on-Trent, which is a little bit more northerly in England. Did a course called Applied Sciences, if I'm remembering the course name correctly. And the idea was there was all sorts of different science-based courses that you could choose. You choose sort of three at the start and then sort of specialize as you went on. Computer science was one of the three I picked there. I also did math and geology. I had no background in geology. It seemed like an interesting thing at the time. That was where I really found my passion for IT and computers, because I hadn't really had a big exposure to it at that point. And to be honest, I hadn't been a motivated student at that point. I think it was part of why I really changing my mind about whether to stay in the education system or not. I don't think I'd found what really worked for me. And I sort of just skating through and wasn't really applying myself at that point. But when I started getting into those computer sciences courses, I found it was something that's just naturally right to me. It just seemed to fit with the way my mind worked, and I enjoyed it. And I would find myself just working on a coding assignment and just working through the night without even realizing it, because I was so invested in what I was doing, and made a huge difference to me, I think.
The coding jag.
Yeah.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
You did some work on the Vax VMS system there, right?
Yeah, so most of what we did there was based on mainframes, mostly Vax VMS. Did have access to some Unix systems, a little bit of PC work, but not that much. Most of what we did was on Vax VMS, and I remember while I was there, I sort of inherited a piece of software. I honestly don't remember all the details now, but I think, you know, one of the older students was heading off, and they'd been managing this chat room on steroids almost, and they decided to hand it off to me. So I sort of inherited this and ran this from my account on this Vax VMS system. So it was basically just a chat room, but there were like little sort of additional things where you could move around from place to place. And I even started trying to see if I could even bridge that gap and turn it into more of like a role-playing game kind of thing and really add on to that. So I did a little bit of enhancements, changed some of the stuff. But that was a great way to get to know people around the college. You know, everyone was logging into this social thing. I guess you could even consider it like a forerunner of a Facebook or something like that. Obviously, nothing I turned into a multi-billion dollar company. But it was a social thing, and I definitely learned quite a bit just having to deal with how it interacted with the Vax system. And I think it was written in Pascal, if I remember correctly, so learning a little bit about coding in that and so on. That was very interesting, yeah.
I imagine you're all over the command line using like Gopher and Finger and Telnet and FTP and maybe even primitive browsers too.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, definitely doing a little bit of that. And I remember we would try and work out how to get into the sort of dumb terminals for accessing the mainframe, but they ran on their own sort of network and operating system, and you could get into that and manage to find out the password for that system once, which allowed us to have some fun with people. You could just see someone sitting just a few rows from you and start sending things to their terminal. It was a lot of fun. But sorry, I forgot you were prompting me for something else, I think, there. And
Gopher, FTP, primitive web browsers.
Primitive web browsers, yes. Yeah, so, and maybe jumping ahead a little bit here, was I transferred to Coventry University after a couple of years, Staffordshire. And that's when I started to see the early signs of the internet and web browsers. Back in Staffordshire, we'd only had one shared email for the entire course, because we weren't doing a lot with the internet. We did go to FTP sites and download pictures from the NASA site and that kind of stuff. I want to say UMass Lowell was quite big on the FTP sites back then. I think I remember hitting their servers for some stuff. And then at Coventry, that was when I would be on Usenet a lot then, all of those groups. And I used to talk to a well-known English author called Terry Pratchett, science fiction fantasy. And he was on there, and you get to have conversations with him through that. And that was where I started to see people talk about this new World Wide Web and HTTP. As that started to come out, we got access to a Lynx browser on the Unix system. At that point, we're still on these green screen dumb terminals, so it wasn't anything like the experience today. You have like just a little box that says there's an image here, but I can't show you what it is. And, you know, it's all sort of text-based.
Yeah, the kids don't know how good they have it, you know? Now they have Reddit and like all sorts of pictures and videos and all sorts of interaction. Like we had Usenet, like text only posting. And
if you wanted the picture on Usenet, there was the alt.binaries groups. You'd have to get like 20 different messages and merge them together and decode all of the ASCII in there.
The binary was actually re-encoded to ASCII using UU encode, and then you'd have to concatenate them all together and then convert them back to binary and then actually be able to open them and pray that it worked.
Yes. Yeah. It was
brutal.
It was.
And that you were starting to fool around with the first Linux distributions around then?
Yeah. So I don't remember exactly how the timelines lined up. If I remember correctly, it wasn't long after we'd actually got access to real browsers, like Netscape, I think, was the one at the time, and Linux really started getting going. At this point, obviously, very different, again, from how it is today. Today, I can just go and download a distribution, one click, and it's installed, and it's all a GUI, and it's wonderfully easy. Back then, it was really just that pure version that Linus Torvalds had developed. You had to edit all of the drivers and things yourself and compile everything for your particular system. I had I think it was an old 386, if I remember correctly, and I'd have to go look, okay, what's the refresh rate on my monitor, and then go into the drivers and get everything set up correctly for that and then compile that driver. And it was quite an effort to get that up and running.
Changing like a pound define in a header file before you compiled it.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. All that stuff. Yeah.
That's brutal. So what's your first kind of real job out of school like?
So the first real job out of school was for a company called PA Consulting. Not that well known over here. They have a small presence in the US, but much bigger in the UK and in Europe. Sort of up there with big consultancy organizations over there, like an Accenture or Deloitte or someone like that. To be honest, I was a little surprised I managed to land that one. I didn't have the most glorious academic career, and so I didn't feel I had the strongest resume, but I think I must have done a pretty effective job when I made it to the interview. I was even surprised I got that far, but it ended up being a fantastic experience. So yeah, it's just traditional management consulting. Obviously, I was very focused on the technology side of that. It meant a lot of development work, but also IT strategies and project management and all the stuff that goes with that. Well, I think one of the big things always sticks in my mind from that was actually my first position there, working for, it was actually a big oil company, working on a procurement system. I sort of joined in the middle of this project that was already going, an existing team. And they basically sat me down and said, hey, we want you to work on this database. My first reaction is, well, I don't know how to do that. Well, you better learn. That's how this job works. And so I started digging in. I touched SQL in my college courses, but really didn't remember anything from that. And so I was pretty much starting from scratch, but taught myself the ins and outs of SQL and then took over all of the development and management of the, they were working in Oracle on that one in particular. So got all that going. Actually ended up that I've constantly sort of come back to SQL in my career. And it's actually one of the ones I feel I still could actually go back in right now and be effective in. I don't think it's moved on quite as much as some of the other ones. I used to do a lot of coding in web front ends and doing JavaScript. And while the basics of JavaScript probably aren't radically different, you know, all the frameworks that have come in, I haven't really been hands-on with those. There'd be a big learning curve. Whereas you give me a SQL query, I can go in and I can tune that right now.
As we'll see later on. So you work on some Y2K stuff while you're there too. Got to travel around a bit. What made you want to kind of move on from there?
Yeah, I did Y2K and that was what brought me over to the US. So PA Consulting were looking to expand their footprint here. They had a very minor footprint in the Boston area and in New Jersey and asked a few of us to come over. And it was like a startup. We came over, we were doing everything, all of the business development and the delivery and everything went with that. But we had that backing of a bigger company, which was a really nice way to do it, and worked very closely with some people who became very good friends. And it was very much a sort of play hard, work hard kind of environment. We had a lot of fun projects. The lifestyle of a consultant gets tiring after a while. So I was there for about 9 years. At that point, I met my wife. We had our first child. And that constant, just 5 days a week, 50 weeks a year being on the road just didn't really fit anymore. So it was time to move on. I decided that I wanted to stay in the consulting world, but find something that gave me a little bit more time at home. So I went to 170 Systems. We were a fairly small, I think we had 100 people when I joined. So a small little company. And they had a product that they designed to plug into the big ERP systems, SAP, Oracle Applications, PeopleSoft at the time, and automate workflows around accounts payable, accounts receivable, that kind of stuff. So if a company gets an invoice coming in, they can scan it in, and then it's all in the system and follows the electronic workflow, goes to the right people for approvals, and so on. So I was with their consulting, basically working with their clients to customize and configure that solution and install it for them. So it was still in the consulting world, but hands-on coding as well. As one of the things I did while I was there was actually build them a new little product. As with any consulting organization, if a client says, hey, we want this, then you're going to say, yep, we'll do that. Just tell us what you want. We'll build it. And so they wanted, it was a time management kind of piece. It was a fairly easy thing, but I had to integrate with Oracle Applications in a way that they hadn't previously, and then was able to sort of hand that off to the product team to deploy to other clients. That was a very interesting experience because I got to really dig into Oracle's code. I think as a developer, when you see someone else's code, you always think, oh, what is this? Who did this? You look at someone else's work and this isn't right. What were you thinking when you did this?
I would have done this differently.
Yeah. I think, you know, Oracle is obviously, you know, still a huge, huge organization. And in my head, I assumed all their code must be pristine and perfect. And as I get in there, it's the same kind of thing that I'm seeing everywhere else where I'm digging into people's code. And that was quite enlightening.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features.
To deploy the release,
deliver first. You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
Now, from there, do you move on to Decision Resources Group?
Yeah, so that was actually a former client when I was at PA. I'd done some work for them and knew the CIO there, and they just got some venture capital money. So she was looking to bring in someone to help her sort of grow the IT organization as the rest of the organization grew. So she offered me a role there, and it seemed too good to turn down at the time. So I went over there and started that. That was another sort of 9-year relationship there at Decision Resources. We went from 20 people, something like that. And when I left there, we were over 200. So a lot of growth. We went through a lot of acquisitions and mergers with other organizations. They were in the healthcare analytics space. So looking at clinical trials and how different drugs are performing in the clinical trials and forecasting out future success and revenue. So they were used by a lot of the big pharma companies to plan out what their portfolios look like and see where they had gaps and challenges they might need to address. One of the acquisitions was a company that looked into how different drugs were available on the health insurance markets for patients. And they worked closely with the big pharma companies. So the pharma companies could work with the doctors to let them know basically what a drug was going to cost their patients. So they'd know when they were prescribing this drug, is this going to be expensive for my patient or is this something that can be more affordable? Obviously, for the pharma companies, they just want to persuade them to prescribe their drug. But for the doctors, they can use that to determine what's an effective but affordable drug for my patient.
Were there any kind of bumps in the road or changes in leadership while you were there?
Yeah, I mean, I actually went through a few different CIOs I worked with. The CIO that brought me in, she left within the first couple of years. And then we had the chief strategy officer. He took over for a while. Very different kind of leadership. So my first CIO, she was very laid back, very easy to get along with. And then the chief strategy officer was a great guy. Really, really like him, but just a completely different way of working. Very intense and really, really drove people very hard. And so that was quite a big adjustment to go from those different leadership styles. But I was able to step up and meet what he was looking for and keep things going. And we had another CIO that came in about a year after he took over, and he moved, sort of focused more on his strategy role. And we got a little bit more laid back at that point, which, you know, allowed me to relax a little bit. But generally, yeah, it was good relationships with the CIOs there, and we were able to do some good stuff.
From a technology perspective, there must have been the old, hey, do we fork the code for every client or how do we keep one mainline going? Did you meet that challenge there?
Yeah. So I mentioned that acquisition that focused on drug costs in the different insurance plans. So when they first came on board, you know, we were absorbing their system. They were a very small startup and they'd been very successful, growing very quickly. But, you know, they started by delivering a product for one client and then they wanted to deliver for a second client. So they basically just duplicated the code base and then started customizing for that client and so on. So every single client that we had had an entirely separate fork of the code base, which I'm sure many people in the industry are going to know is it's a very difficult thing to manage effectively and particularly to scale up. And obviously, we wanted to keep growing this organization and keep scaling that up. So day one, when I got a look at this, I said, I think we need to look at trying to turn this into a multi-tenant solution. So look at what we can do here to create a single code base, put in customization points and so on, so that we can keep in all these customizations in place. I got a lot of pushback on that. They had an existing team that were developing this, and obviously I didn't understand their business model fully at that point. So they pushed back hard and you guys know this better than me. So we'll leave it as is and we'll go from there. And then I think it was a couple of years later, it became very clear that it was going to be unsustainable in this model, and we had to make that decision to basically rebuild this entire platform. We basically started from scratch building a new platform that we could then move people over to as we got that to maturity.
If you could talk to younger Matt, would you say stand your ground, dig in your heels on this forking conversation?
Yeah, that's definitely one of the things I look back at. And I don't think I've ever been the most confident person in, you know, in my role. I think I am one of those people who sometimes has that imposter syndrome. And I've seen similar things in myself in the past. I remember back at PA, I came in to take over a project. Actually, this was for Decision Resources. They were the client at the time. We were building this database and you could almost call it sort of a forerunner of some of the newer sort of unstructured database technologies. We were trying to sort of do something ourselves without using standard database technologies. And the way it was architected, I looked at it and it seemed to have this sort of superfluous table in there. And I kept looking at it like, I don't think this is right. And the guy who put this together was someone I consider a bit of a mentor and someone I had a lot of respect for. And he said, "Now, trust me, you're going to need this. You'll see later on." So obviously I had a lot of respect for him, so I didn't question. And as it came down to it, as we really got that implemented and were working with it, we kept getting these little problems that we had to keep working around because of this superfluous table that was in that structure. And coming out of that, I was like, no, I should have stood my ground. And there's definitely been a handful of times in my career where I feel I should have stood my ground. Now, to be completely fair, there's probably been plenty of times where I shouldn't have stood my ground. And, you know, we always have that selective memory, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I've had a few of each. You also end up having to work with an offshore team quite a bit towards the tail end of that stint as well, right?
Yeah, that was quite a learning experience. I think I mentioned Decision Resources Group. When they brought me in, they'd just been acquired by a venture capital company, so they had a lot of money. They then went to, you know, these VCs, typically it's like a 5-year thing. So they then went to another VC, and then that VC ended up selling to a large Indian company. They were called Piramal. It's not a name most people are probably familiar with, but they're a multi-billion dollar company out there, family owned in a lot of different areas. And they saw DRG as their sort of way into the data and analytics market. And so once they bought us, they wanted us to take advantage of Indian labor costs, like most companies are these days. But rather than outsourcing to a third party, they wanted to do it in-house. So we'd actually set up our offices over there and hire directly. So I was very heavily involved in that, went out to Bangalore a couple of times, which is where we were setting up our office. And doing anything in a different country, there's cultural things you've got to deal with. Before this, we did some outsourcing to Costa Rica. And that was proper outsourcing to a third-party company. And there were, you know, little cultural things that we learned about there. But India was definitely a bigger shift. The biggest challenge we had was with hiring. And I was actually talking to some people just the other day about this, and they're still having these issues. It's still a huge challenge to find and retain talent in India. And what we saw was, firstly, as you look at resumes and then you interview, it often seems to be genuinely a different person that wrote the resume that actually shows up to interview. So we started implementing various tools and techniques to manage that. We'd set like a standard test for each kind of role. So, right, we were doing a lot in Ruby and Rails, for example. So we need a Rails developer. We would come up with just like a simple sort of 10-question test just to make sure they know some of the basic concepts that they can actually code in Rails, not complicated challenges, but just that they recognize the difference between a constant and a variable or something like that, you know, something very simple. They would have to do these tests, but they would do them on camera. So we'd have a recorded footage of who took the test. The software we got would also check to make sure whether they were hopping onto Google to check these things and so on. So we make sure that the person who took the test knew at least the basics of what we were looking for. And we'd have pictures of them. So we'd know the person who showed up for the in-person interview was the same person that took the test. And that definitely helped a lot. And we were able to get a lot more solid candidates coming through. But then the challenge we have is they'd accept an offer. So we get an offer in. And then by law, there's a 3-month waiting period in Bangalore. And I think it varies a little bit in different parts of India. But in Bangalore at the time, it was 3 months. So they'd have to give 3 months notice to their previous employer. And we'd have to wait 3 months for them to join. And we'd reach out to them and just keep checking in with them, just making sure we're still on 3 months time, 2 months time, et cetera, et cetera. And they'd always be, yep, yep. And then you get to the day they join, just wouldn't show up. You'd find out they'd leveraged your offer for a 20% bump at Amazon or something and gone there. So that the 3-month waiting period was just giving people an opportunity to keep finding better positions. We tried to put in like hiring some joining bonuses and other things to try and compete with that. The biggest challenge is the status of the organization you work for is a big thing over there. So we struggled because no one had heard of Decision Resources Group and got Amazon and Google and all those kind of names out there. That's where they want to go. So, you know, we'd have to try and offer above the going rate to try and counteract that. And we did try and leverage the Pramal name because although not known over here, it's a fairly recognizable name over there.
So did you have any interesting stories pulling the fat out of the fire for some clients while you were there?
Yeah. Actually, it's this same product I've been talking about around the healthcare, customized for every client. And so we had one client that had slightly different feature set to the others, and they use a lot of their own data that they were pumping in there, and they kept adding more and more data. The volumes were increasing, and the whole environment was slowing down, and they got to the point where reports weren't coming back and were timing out. And we were coming up to renewal time with them, and it was a multi-million dollar deal. So there was a lot of pressure to resolve that. And this is actually, I think, one of the times where I realized I like the operations world. I actually enjoy the sort of stress and pressure that comes with that. I find I work well in that environment. And so we had to react quickly to this. So we came up with a sort of a multi-step plan, worked out what we could do really quickly. And some of that was just start throwing hardware at the machines. At the time, this was hosted out in Rackspace. And there were certain things we could do on the hardware we had that would buy us a bit of breathing room and just allow some of this stuff to run. And we worked with the development team to look at what we could do from a code base perspective. And then we basically came up with a 2-month plan that started out with some real good quick wins just to ease the performance issues for them. And then some coding changes that would come in a few weeks later that would get us some real changes there. And then we ended up with a migration to brand new hardware in Rackspace. This was sort of in the early days of SSDs coming out, solid state disk, and we went for a full array of solid state disks on the new hardware. It gave us crazy high IOPS and really dealt with the last of the performance issues with those volumes of data.
I remember at Monster, there was a time when they said, what else can we do to make Siebel faster? And they ended up going with RAM disks. If you throw enough money at the problem,
yeah,
and enough solid state hardware. Do you end up doing some consulting after that?
Yeah. So at the end of my time at DRG, basically the entire technology group was effectively moving out to India. So my time there was done. So I did do a little bit of consulting, just trying to work out what the next thing was going to be. So worked for a couple of different consulting organizations. And I actually sort of started to settle at a place called Knowledgent. But along the way, I'd applied for a position at the state. And things move slowly in the public sector. So I'd actually not long started at this at Knowledgent and was enjoying my time there and settling in there, where I got the offer at the state, which was frankly something I didn't feel I could turn down. So it did feel incredibly guilty having to hand my notice in only a few months after starting, but it felt like what I had to do.
So they made you an offer you couldn't refuse.
Yes.
You go in there, and what is the technology you're working with? Like, what is it actually, what does the Department of Transportation do tech-wise?
I wasn't clear when I first applied for the position exactly what that meant. They have two big areas that they focus on, which is the RMV. And in Massachusetts, we have an RMV as opposed to a DMV, and then the highways. But they also do a little bit with aeronautics. We have Massport, who does all of the Logan and the big airports and so on. And they do a little bit with rail and transit. But all of the passenger rail is MBTA. The DOT manages the rail associated with the freight and so on. But it's a very small piece of what they do. So for the RMV, you know, we're obviously, we have all of the service centers giving out licenses, registrations, et cetera, and everything that goes with that. Also, interestingly, that's, we are effectively a retail organization. So we get into PCI compliance for dealing with credit cards and so on. And then on the highway side, there's a lot of technology around the highway, including tolling, and we're starting to get into the automated cars and things like that. One of the bigger pieces there is what's called intelligent transportation systems. And a lot of that comes from the Big Dig, which is famous outside of Boston. But so the tunnels are full of ventilation systems and fire suppression and cameras and It's actually some really cool technology. We have what's called the Highway Operations Center. Sits actually in the Seaport District, and it's very much like a NASA mission control kind of place. Huge walls just full of screens watching all of the highways. We've got cameras on all the major highways and all of everything that's going on in the tunnel. That's manned 24/7, and they're coordinating responses to accidents and breakdowns and so on. You know, they're working closely with the emergency services to make sure they can get there quickly. Obviously working with the highway teams to close off lanes and redirect as necessary and so on.
So when I see those big towers next to the highway with the camera on the top, that's you guys keeping an eye on that?
Yep. And all the signs with the occasionally humorous messages and so on. Yeah.
Use your blinker.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
I got a kick out of that one. What was the biggest adjustment for you moving from the private sector to the public sector?
There's a lot of little differences there. Technologically, we're probably a little behind on compared to some private sector, not that far behind. You know, I did a lot of work with the pharmaceutical industry. They tend to be quite far behind from a technological perspective. And any environment where you've got a lot of regulation, things tend to move a little more slowly. I think the biggest difference is the unionized workforce. You really don't see that in the technology world outside of the government. As a manager, that changes your whole toolkit and how you have to manage teams. So, you know, in the private sector, we'd have performance matrices and we'd rate people against these matrices regularly. And if someone's doing well, you can reward them. And if someone's consistently underperforming, you can manage them out, whether that's into a different role or out of the organization. You know, you've got a lot more control. Theoretically, all of that is available in a unionized environment, but everything has to be negotiated with the union ahead of time if you're going to do anything like that. Like if I want to rate someone on a particular scale or change how we define that scale, that whole thing has got to be negotiated with the union. And that's not something I can do. That's something that's way, way bigger than me that goes across multiple agencies and so on. So we have to work within those constraints. And it definitely takes many tools out of your toolbox as a manager. So that's a big shift.
How did the state do? You mentioned most regulated agencies, they tend to move a little slower. How was their reaction to Friday the 13th, March 2020, when the whole world pumped the brakes on going into the office?
We actually did pretty well with that. I mean, it was a big adjustment. So the Department of Transportation, I think the state as a whole, was generally very much a desktop-based, you must be in the office to work kind of organization pre-pandemic. So we weren't set up for people working from home. That wasn't something that people typically did. And we were actually already in the process of thinking about how to get to be more flexible from that perspective. So we'd been doing, you know, sort of DR work and BCP kind of work and thinking about what that would look like. And one of the things that was coming out of that was if we lose locations, we want people to be able to work from home. That's our contingency. Should we lose a location? And we immediately, from a technology perspective, like, well, we are not set up for that. We don't have the VPN capacity. People don't have laptops and so on. So we were starting to think about, we need to migrate our entire user base to laptops. We need to set up these applications differently so they can be effectively used off the network and take strain off the VPN and so on. Right as the pandemic was starting, right before they locked everything down, we were actually in sort of tabletop exercises going through this stuff and talking through this. And then I think it was like the week after, that was when everything officially shut down. And at that point, we scrambled. And given where we started, I think we did a fantastic job and moved very quickly. Within the state, as you talk about regulations, there's a very strict procurement process. We can't just go and buy something from anyone. We have to put everything out to bid. There's all these rules to make sure that no one's giving something to their best mate's company or whatever it may be. But we had to get exceptions to that because everyone wanted laptops at that time. So you couldn't just go to your normal vendors and get a laptop. So we literally reached out to Staples. You know, what have you got in stock? What can you get us in the next couple of weeks? And I think we bought about 900 laptops.
I was going to say, who'd you call and say, hey, you got 1,000 laptops on hand?
There's a main agency that oversees technology across the Commonwealth called the Executive Office of Technology Services and Security. And they were able to help us out with some. They had some in stock. Staples and other vendors like that, we were able to go out and say, what have you got? What can you get us? And we were a little selective to make sure it was things that fit with what we were able to support. We tried to be fairly consistent with that. But yeah, we were able to get about 900 or so in and just get them deployed quickly to people to get them up and running. So we definitely had some slowdown. We had some VPN capacity issues. But within a couple of weeks, we had most people working pretty effectively.
Excellent. Now, when you're away from keyboard, you do the kind of standard hanging out with the family and skiing and snowboarding, but you also listed curling, and you would be the first non-Canadian I know that's into curling. How did that come about?
Through my kids and like friends of the family, actually. So I've known people who've curled before. So at Decision Resources Group, we had a office in Toronto, one of their acquisitions with a Canadian company, and I spent a bit of time out there, and a couple people there were curlers, as a lot of people in Canada tend to be, but I'd never actually tried it at that point. And then our kids have a couple of good friends, you know, they're sort of, you know, friends of the family, and they started curling. There's a place called Broomstones in, I would say, Wayland, just west of Boston. They were curling there, and so my kids decided they wanted to try it out. So they tried it out, and I decided to give it a go. I signed up. There's a big waitlist. It's a surprisingly popular sport. About 6 months ago or so, I finally got the call that, hey, you know, you've got the front of the line. It's your time. So they do a curling league there. So past few months, I've been learning how to curl and just sort of graduated from that into, I wouldn't maybe call it competition, but into the real world of curling.
Now, is it like a shuffleboard or a bocce on ice where you're trying to kind of massage exactly where the thing goes, or how does that work?
The first thing it struck me as being similar to is there's a game called bowls in England, and it has these sort of, they're not like typical round balls, they're all sort of like squished, and they're weighted to one side, so you roll them down this, it's played on grass, and you roll them down the green, and they naturally curve. It's a little sort of similar thing. The goal with that is you throw a little jack ball, and you're trying to get as close to that as possible. As we record this, the Olympics are on, and I'm sure everyone's been watching a bit of curling. It seems to be one of the more popular Olympic sports these days. It's the same kind of thing. You're trying to get that rock in the middle of the circle, and whoever's closest gets the points, basically. But the rocks are designed to curl a little bit as they go down the ice. And then the sweeping is all about trying to adjust the weight, how fast it's getting, you know, where it's going to end up, and also the line, because as you sweep, that impacts the line as well. It's definitely a team sport. Person throwing the rock is doing their best to get it online, but then everyone else is trying to help it and just get it just the right place.
So Matt, thank you very much for coming down and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Thank you very much. It's been great to be here, and I can't wait to hear the finished product.
We're looking forward to it as well. And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.